Hey, what's so funny? Thanks for downloading the very latest from peterbcollins.com. You're about to hear another great conversation in the Boiling Frogs interview series with Sabelle Edmonds and Pepe Escobar. I want to thank the people who subscribe to this program and make it possible on a regular basis. You can do it too. All the links are right under my picture on the homepage at peterbcollins.com. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. But today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs with Sabelle Edmonds. I'm Peter B. Collins, and today, once again, we welcome globe-trotting journalist Pepe Escobar to our program. Pepe, Sabelle, greetings.
Greetings. Always a pleasure to be with you guys.
Hello.
And Sabelle, I just want to comment as we listen to the pre-recorded introduction that you recorded for me, what, almost 4 years ago? The topics that you list are still in contention and more newsworthy than ever. The perpetual war, the NSA's wall-to-wall surveillance, the no-fly list has probably dropped in visibility a little bit. But so many of those other issues are still very important to us. The water is heating up, and the frogs are passing out. And this week, we saw the confirmation that was news to many, but not to the three of us, of the widespread surveillance of Americans, as Glenn Greenwald courageously published the super-secret FISA court decision that enabled continuous collection of phone records from Verizon, and presumably there are orders like this for every phone company. But it is the dragnet that sweeps up information on every American, innocent or otherwise. And you and I got confirmation from James Bamford just a few years ago, Russell Tice, the whistleblower from the NSA and the DIA, also appeared with us on the Boiling Frogs podcast, and others. More recently, I spoke to Thomas Drake and to others at the NSA or former NSA workers. And so tell me your thoughts, Sabelle, as you saw this news cascading out and the second day story that the internet, big internet providers, including Google and Yahoo and others, are directly tapped into by the NSA. And they can, as we're typing in a search engine request, they can even anticipate what we're thinking. So this massive surveillance of the American people with the collusion of the executive, the legislative, the Congress branch, and also the courts is stunning to many people, but it's not news to you.
Absolutely. As you just emphasized, not news. As you just told us, we had, as National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, in 2005, we issued several press releases. At the time, we had two whistleblowers from the NSA. One was already public, and that was Russell Tice, Russ Tice, you just mentioned him. And the other whistleblower, he never came fully public, although he contacted us, and through our press releases and through our calls to Congress, we tried to get him before the members of the Senate and House Intelligence Committees. All these were happening in 2005. I just wrote a piece and posted it at Boiling Frogs Post. And in this article, I actually copy-pasted that press release in 2005. And this was Russell Tice talking about how it actually, these illegal surveillance system, eavesdropping, data gathering went way beyond only the AT&T. The fact that this was this huge vacuum sucking everything up into the NSA's database. And this included various, you know, hosting companies, Google, other phone companies. And now we are hearing about even the credit card companies. So these things took place in 2005. Guess what, Peter? When he issued the press release with Russell Tice and with his statements, nobody covered in the mainstream media. No one, not a single mainstream media publication picked it up. And with Congress, we finally were able to arrange meetings between Russell Tice and another NSA whistleblower. And this was both Intelligence Committee in the House and the Senate. And these whistleblowers, these insiders, these veteran NSA experts briefed Congress exactly on what we are reading today that is suddenly coming out as this major expose. And they did nothing. So one thing, though, is interesting because you have Feinstein and other people in Congress coming and saying, oh, well, no, we knew all about this. This has been going on since 2007. Well, that's partially correct because, yes, the United States Congress has known about this for almost a decade, not since 2007, but since 2004 and or maybe even earlier. But the fact that the same United States Congress has done nothing about this. And they're actually coming out publicly and saying, it's okay, we know about it. What's the problem here? Don't we have this war on terror? And as I said, mainstream media didn't pick it up. Another interesting point quickly to mention here has to do with the fact that this not so really news or expose came out from Guardian UK rather than any kind of a publication here. And as you can see, suddenly now Washington Post, New York Times, as it has happened so many times before, they are coming right after the fact and covering it and saying, okay, this is a hot topic, we are covering it. But the story, even though it's the non-story, didn't break here in the U.S. media. It was imported from the U.K.'s Guardian. And the third thing I want to mention is this. I have a very strong hunch that something is going to happen to the whistleblower or whistleblowers from NSA or the Justice Department who made this court order public and went to the Guardian. Mm-hmm. He or she or they are in grave danger because even though the story broke, they have not gone to a reliable, trustworthy source. So if we end up hearing about the identity of this whistleblower being exposed, and of course, with attached retaliation, I want to go ahead and say it right now, it's going to be solely due to some arrangements that the top people in Guardian have with our government, and they have had it for a long time. And I feel really alarmed and worried for whoever these whistleblowers were or are who went to the Guardian. Again, it's unfortunate because, of course, nobody would do it in the United States and they would be even more dangerous than Guardian UK, but they have not gone to a good trusted source.
Well, that's a very interesting point. To your previous point about the New York Times, they had a chest-thumping editorial denouncing the Obama administration, and I agreed with everything in the editorial, except they failed to mention their own complicity. In keeping this secret, they learned about it in 2004. James Risen and Eric Lichtblau did. They sat on it for a full year until Bush had been installed for a second term. You note I didn't say reelected. And they only published it because James Risen had a book coming out that was going to make the Times look really stupid. And in the intervening years, while Charlie Savage has done some decent reporting at the Times, they have only reported what they had to and not really done much to expose this massive collection of data on American citizens. And, Sibel, with your indulgence, I just want to read briefly from your recent post following on The Guardian's disclosures. You say, what does this tell us? That the executive branch of the United States of America has been illegally and continuously engaged in surveillance of all of its citizens. That the United States Congress has been briefed and reported on this illegal, unconstitutional surveillance and has readily gone along with it as collaborators. That the U.S. federal courts have been sitting on the sidelines and allowing the continuation of the illegal, unconstitutional surveillance of United States citizens. That the media in the United States has firmly positioned itself as government collaborators in this illegal, unconstitutional practice against the citizens of the U.S. And finally, and I would add most importantly, that the citizens of the United States of America are in a position to decide to act or not to act against this four-branch police state. And we'll talk about Turkey a little later, but the demonstrations there that are in the vast majority of the cities of Turkey put Americans to shame, Sibel, when it comes to standing up for our alleged constitutional rights.
Absolutely. And as you have done so with me, we have been waiting for the past 11 years to see the sign of outrage, to see some displaying of spine by the majority in the United States of America. And no matter what is happening, whether we have these exposés on these incredible torture practices, or the FBI's national security letters, or the surveillance police state practices by the NSA, the NDAA, the Patriot Act, I mean, the groping by the TSA as we traveled, you know, You add all the stuff, and with all these latest and with and perpetual wars, of course, we have not seen any real reaction from the Americans. And that is mind-boggling. I've been on the phone daily with my contacts, with my friends, with some reporters in Turkey, and as we are talking over the phone, Peter, and this is 10:30 p.m. in Istanbul, in a suburban community, a small suburban community, upper middle class, I hear these banging, and I say, what is that sound? And she says, they have about two dozens of old ladies from the neighborhood, the suburban communities. They are over 70 years old. They're walking around the gated community with their pots and pans, banging it against each other, in order to show their solidarity with the protests, with the majority in Turkey. You get that from even these elderly in Turkey. And here in the United States, you look at people, the majority show you this numb, dumb, I don't have any better adjective to use here, spineless, indifference, the apathy. So in the end, it boils down to the people. The reason we have these four branches get away and continue and expand and escalate these practices are solely due to the inaction of the Americans. And we need to turn around and say, after finger pointing to these four scumbag branches, we need to point finger at ourselves and say, we are at fault. And the responsibility is ours. Here is today, with all the scandals breaking, you know, from the IRS spying, from this latest with the NSA, we need to show spine. We need to get up and put an end to it. And as long as we don't see any indications of that, all we are going to see is going to be more escalations, more violations, and we have arrived. It's been a long time since we've arrived to this constant police state status as a nation.
Pepe Escobar, you are safely offshore once again, and we always value your perspective.
No, I'm not. I'm not. I am a known U.S. person outside of the U.S.
Okay.
So, well, this means I have been under surveillance like forever.
Well, I'm sure there's a very thick file on you, Mr. Escobar. But I do want to thank you for staying up late to join us from Bangkok tonight. And I want to get your... I want to get your thoughts on this confirmation of what we have known for many years now about the extent and the pervasiveness of surveillance of Americans in the United States.
Now, Sybil laid down the law these past 5 minutes. I have nothing to add. That's exactly it, especially the apathy, consumerism, and, you know, let's see what Paris Hilton or whoever that is doing this right moment, and Facebooking and Twitter every single second. That's it. If this was happening in certain European countries, I would venture to say France and Britain and Germany, it would be mind-boggling. You would have real popular reaction. Even in Italy, the level of political consciousness is much, much higher, in fact. And even if people are in a state of narcolepsy, practically, because of all the seductions of turbo capitalism, they will be out in the streets Turkish style. By the way, what they are doing in Turkey is what they did in Argentina. Late 2001, early 2002, the cacerolazos, banging pots and pans and, throw the bombs out. That's what they were saying in Argentina at the time. And now it's, make the Sultan bomb behave. This is what they're saying, essentially. Mm-hmm. So I have nothing to add to Sybil, except that in my case, I was born in South America. So I grew up with a military dictatorship installed by the U.S. So you acquire a lot of cynicism. So what is happening now? This is something I was discussing with some of my American friends by 2003, 2004. You better be sure that, the surveillance state is all, it's a new Orwellian state all over the place. And yes, you are being watched and listened. And they will tell me, no way, our government will never do this with Americans. Now we have the proof.
Now, Sybil, drawing on your experience as a former employee at the FBI, Robert Mueller was the director for a 10-year term, and that term was set by law to prevent a new J. Edgar Hoover from emerging. And nevertheless, very quietly, 2 years ago, they extended his term to expire this summer. And the good news is that they're not going to try to extend him again. But the bad news is that President Obama has selected a former Republican Ashcroft number two in the Justice Department, in the very period when you served there, to head the FBI. And while there is the episode at the Ashcroft bedside where Comey prevented the forced signing of an extension of one of these orders that is very similar to the FISA court order that has been revealed by Glenn Greenwald, that is about the only moment of courage that I'm aware of in James Comey's career. He is knee-deep in the surveillance state. He was there at the Justice Department that approved the John Yoo memos that redefined torture so we could torture people and say that we weren't. The rendition program, the Patriot Act, all of these, the abuse of national security letters by the FBI, all of these have occurred with the knowledge and expected approval of James Comey. So to see him nominated is simply an extension of the national security state, and it puts in charge somebody who is deeply conversant in virtually every element of the expanded police powers since 9/11.
Well, I wouldn't have expected anything less from Barack Obama. Let me put it that way. And of the scandals you just cited, Peter, there are several other scandals that really involving Comey that never actually was printed in the U.S. mainstream media. And I had an article written by Bill Conroy, and he's the top investigative reporter in Texas, who has been covering for the past 25, 30 years everything that has to do with DEA and the narco trafficking and exposing this sham called war on drugs. And he went ahead and wrote a piece reminding people of the scandals involving James Comey that never made it to the press. And that had to do also with his direct involvement in the House of Death, the Juarez murder cases in in the border of Mexico and Texas, and his role as the main persons who covered up this massive scandal. And of course, the media didn't report this. So the only thing I would add is that I am not surprised. I wouldn't expect anything less from Barack Obama. And later, of course, we are going to hear from Pepe on the other appointments, equally interesting, equally troubling as well, Fox and Rice. And so this just goes in line with the Obama administration's position and Obama's appointments from the day he took office. And it is no different than Bush in any way. And it may prove to be actually even worse in some cases. And I would let Pepe talk about the recent appointments in the foreign policy arena and the implications as well.
All right. We'll get to Susan Rice and Samantha Power in a few moments. I want to turn next to the FBI killing of a Chechen who was living in Orlando, Florida, named Ibrahim Todashev. And this is tangential, apparently, to the investigation of the Tsarnaev brothers who've been fingered for the Boston Marathon bombing. And the accusation is that together with Todashev, the Tsarnaev brothers committed a murder in Waltham, Massachusetts in 2011. And the story, which keeps changing, is that the FBI agent, together with two state troopers from Massachusetts, spent nearly 8 hours interrogating Todashev in his Orlando apartment with no attorney present. The FBI agent reports that at a certain point they had persuaded Todashev to write out a confession, which is often a common way to secure a conviction under questionable circumstances. And the story goes, and this is all based on leaked information from official FBI but anonymous sources, that a confrontation emerged where Todashev reportedly picked up the table that he was writing this confession on and hurled it at the FBI agent, knocking him down and injuring him in the face. Then the story, we get three different versions. One was that Todashev had a knife, and then they said, no, he didn't have a knife. Maybe it was a samurai sword. And then they said, well, maybe it wasn't a samurai sword. Maybe it was a broomstick. And then, well, maybe not a broomstick. Maybe it was a metal pole like from a light fixture. In any event, Todashev was shot 6 times in the frontal torso and a 7th time in the back of his head. The shots apparently were all fired by the FBI agent. The state troopers reportedly did not pull their guns. So this is an episode that begs a complete and independent investigation. The corporate media appears to already have moved on. But I wanted to get comments from each of you because this is another highly questionable episode linked to the Boston Marathon events. And once again, the father of the victim flatly says that his son was set up. Sabelle, you first?
Well, really, when you put this together with everything else we have discussed and we have written about, and of course, with the mainstream media, they are done. They covered for 2 weeks the shenanigan aspects of the Boston terror attack, or if it was a real terror attack, Boston bombing incident, and they quit. They are done. The story is finished, period. Nobody's going to visit it or revisit it. It's the end of the story. We are not going to hear much on that. But as far as the other connections, including the recent revelations from Orlando, put together with Graham Fuller aspects of it that we exposed weeks ago, we know that the entire incident from top to bottom stinks. There is no facts really reported, and we still haven't had. I have been in touch with some people who are still in the FBI, and they have compartmentalized it to such a degree within the FBI that only very few people have inside real knowledge of what was the case, what has been going on. And that includes this whole episode that broke on Russia, you know, calling the FBI and contacting them and telling them about it. Even with that particular incident, you're looking at a very small, compartmentalized unit in the FBI with no access to the rest of the FBI agents. So even if you talk to the people within the FBI, most of them, they're going to shrug and they say it stinks and I have no idea what's happening. In fact, that's exactly the same words used by this FBI agent I spoke with about 7-8 days ago. We have no idea when it comes to this case. It's extremely compartmentalized. And mm-hmm. that itself should tell you something.
Pepe, what are your observations on this case?
Look, I'll be brief. We have to talk about a lot of stuff. I'll go with a good fella's explanation. This guy knew something, anything. He had to be whacked, period.
All right, that was brief.
That makes sense.
And Pepe, is there anything in your research and reporting that is new related to the Caucasus, the Graham Fuller angle, the relationship of Uncle Sarney to the CIA and USAID? Has anything new developed? Because we promised our listeners we would circle back after our most recent conversation.
Yeah, unfortunately not. I think we are still circling back.
All right.
or maybe circling out of it, you know.
And, Sabelle, has the story advanced for you in any meaningful way?
No developments that are directly related or at least in obvious way to the Boston incident, but the area has been simmering because we have been following all the latest developments in Dagestan and in Chechnya, and we have been reporting it in our nightly news. I mean, you have this latest arrest of the mayor there by Putin, which is actually a huge deal. Again, it's not covered by the U.S. media here, but also escalations within the Dagestan region. And I just came across an article that, again, dealt between Georgia and Russia and the whole issue of Abkhazia starting simmering up again. So we have a lot of things happening there that are indirectly related. And a lot of people have come back saying, oh, look, Russia gave Syria all these the anti-missiles and airplanes. See, you were wrong. See, they are wrong because Russia has not delivered those weapons yet. They have been sitting on it. They have put a hold on it. So for people to come and say, see, there has been nothing, no behind-the-scene really agreements or semi-agreements reached because Russia is supplying Syria with weapons. And I keep telling them, wait a second. You have to go and really read these news developments because even though the headlines are misleading, when you get down to it, and when you start looking at the recent statements by Putin, you see that Russia hasn't, you know, they haven't taken any actions. In fact, they have put a hold on this. And that also brings in another interesting point, and this has to do with Syria. And that is, in the end, you know, the winners are the military-industrial complex, okay? Whether it's most of it here in the United States. When people hear about developments like, okay, Kuwait and Qatar and Saudi Arabia, they are supplying all these high-tech weapons to the rebels. Well, none of these nations produce any weapons, okay? Where do they buy it? Where do they get the weapons that they buy, they purchase with their petrodollars? And this is Qatar and Kuwait and the United Emirates. They purchase it from the United States with their petrodollars, and those weapons then transfer to rebels. So in the end, you still have the military-industrial complex saying, hey, this is a good deal. So it drags for longer top periods. You know, we're going to make a few, you know, few dollars on the side. And same thing with the Russians. Now, these orders were placed by Assad. I don't know how the agreements are signed with these weapons deals because do they put down payments for it? But if those orders have been submitted, you know, maybe at the last stage of or in the last stage of this whole conflict, Russians would say, well, you know, let's at least make some money out of this. Maybe we'll give it to the Syrians one day before they fall. I don't know. But It's not as cut and dry as it appears to be. A lot of simmering is happening in the region with Dagestan. Things are heating up between Georgia and Russia behind the scenes. And of course, we still have what's going on with Syria. And I believe one of the reasons we haven't seen much happening from the U.S. side on Syria is all the recent back-to-back scandals that has been hitting have been hitting the Obama administrations. They had the AP story scandal, then they had the IRS scandal, and now, bam, we have all the stuff with NSA coming out again. So right now, currently, the administration is in this position that I don't think they want to take on too many things simultaneously. When the public opinion is kind of going down, it should be like bottom to zero. Unfortunately, it's not. So it went down from 54% to 46%. But that also impacts what has been impacting what has been happening with Syria and U.S. stand on that. Right now, things are really heated up for the administration. But I would say you will see again the issue come up with Syria in forefront and the front pages again soon. And that's my take.
And Pepe, your most recent dispatch regarding Syria is headlined, "Hezbollah Don't Take No Mess." And I'd like you to expand on that a little bit, because the role that Hezbollah has played really in the last 30 days or so has been a real game changer. And as you point out, the battle for Qusair appears to be a turning point for the Assad government.
Yes, absolutely. But the thing is, the way it's being blown up in the U.S. as Hezbollah was one element in a very complex equation. This was a Syrian Arab army. That's why they're the SAA. This was their victory. And they were helped by a few Hezbollah fighters, I would say between 100 and 150, according to my best information, and a few Iranian experts. Why? Because these Iranian experts, they have experience in urban warfare that they acquired when? During the Iran-Iraq war. They had 8 years to become masters of urban warfare. So with these advisors and with the Hezbollah fighters with battleground experience as well, they helped an advance of the Syrian army, which had been going on for almost 6 months. So, you know, to summarize what happened over there. Basically, first they encircled Qusair. Why Qusair is so important? Because it's like 10 kilometers from the Syrian-Lebanese border. Because it was very close to the supply route coming from the Sunnis in Lebanon and going to the different Free Syrian Army or not-so-free Syrian Army gangs in that region, the Hama Homs corridor going north all the way to Aleppo. There's a road over there, the so-called Route 4. I took that road a few times. It's a relatively distant highway, and it's not very well protected in some stretches as well. So the problem is they have this supply route for the so-called rebels. They needed to cut it off. It involved Lebanon, even if it was not South Lebanon. But it's through the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon, but it involved Hezbollah could help because they know the terrain as well, even though if it's not in South Lebanon. So what did the Syrian army do? What did they do this past 6 months? First thing, encircled Qusair. There was one hardcore brigade that was more or less controlling Qusair since, a little over a year, in fact. The Al-Faruq Brigade. It's one of the top two Free Syrian Army outfits, militias, whatever you want to call it. And the other one that's really hardcore is the Al-Tahid Brigade, which is controlling like two suburbs of Aleppo in the north. When the guys in Qusair, the Al-Faruq, saw that they were being circled, they called for help from Al-Tahid in Aleppo. So when the Al-Tahid, they sent some of their best fighters south, the Syrian army, they retreated. They let them go through what would be the Syrian army circle. And when they had the two brigades encircled inside, Qusair, they attacked. And that happened over the past 2 weeks. So, you know, classic good military strategy. So how do you do that? First of all, you have a good army, you know, like the Syrian army is a relatively decent army for Middle Eastern standards. And you have some very good point men, Hezbollah and Iranians, telling you how to organize yourself in urban warfare. So it was a done deal. When I figured that out a few weeks ago, I said, well, they're going to take Qusair. Could take a week, could take two, could take a month. But yeah, it took them 2 weeks. So it's inevitable. And obviously, the way this was covered in Western media, not only American press, but I read all the European papers almost every day. Asad Abu Khalil, the angry Arab blogger, he defined it in one sentence. It was like a death in the family, the way it was covered by everybody. And that's exactly it, because first of all, nobody was expecting. Second, if you had any reporters on the ground, they were with the rebels. And in fact, they were not even inside Qusair. There was nobody in Qusair, because the civilians in Qusair had left a long time ago. Qusair is a city of 30,000, more or less. Everybody left. There were only a few farmers in the countryside nearby in the area. So there were no observers on the ground to see what was happening, and obviously there were no reporters with the Syrian army, the Syrian Arab army, to tell people in the West, look, they are encircling Qusair. There's going to be an offensive. So when it happened, everybody, whoa, what's going on? Oh, you know, you had to be there, or you had to have at least some good information related to what the army was doing, and that's exactly what happened. So what Hezbollah was, I would say, 20-30% of the equation. And now you see, especially in Western media, oh, Hezbollah now is fighting side by side with the Assad regime. They're going to stay in Syria. No, their mission is very localized. They're going to protect the Syrian-Lebanese border. And eventually they're going to protect the Syrian side as well of the Syrian-Lebanese border. It's a very porous border over there. But they're going to be there because it's their interest. And another thing, just to sum it all up, you may remember that over the past few weeks, different strands of U.S. Think tank land, they were spoiling for a fight. Hezbollah against Al-Qaeda inside Syria. Well, they got their wish.
And they're probably a little disappointed.
There's a death in the family.
Yeah. Now, Pepe, I think this is the perfect opportunity to interject the shuffle in the Obama inner circle, which brings in no new voices, no new viewpoints, no new thinking. But he's moving Susan Benghazi Rice from the United Nations to become his national security advisor. Doesn't require Senate confirmation. Pisses off the Republicans. Then he is moving Samantha Power from his inner circle of security advisors to replace Rice as the ambassador to the United Nations. That will require Senate approval. What are your thoughts about the ascent of these humanitarian hawks into a more prominent role in Obama's decision-making process?
Well, I'll try to be light for a start. The Susan and Samantha show, this is going to be fun, I tell you. It's not going to be fun for a lot of people in the Middle East. But the thing is, nowadays, they won't get away with what they had with Libya. We all remember that the three graces of humanitarian imperialism were Hillary, Susan, and Samantha. They sold humanitarian imperialism, R2P to Obama. And then they mounted the offensive in the UN Security Council, trying to fool everybody who was deeply against it, in fact, which was the BRIC countries plus Germany, trying to sell the idea that, no, this is a no-fly zone, it's going to be harmless, nothing's going to happen. And obviously, the minute resolution was voted with the extensions of the BRICS plus Germany, we had a war going on in Libya. So this is not going to happen again. They tried with Syria three times, and Russia and China vetoed. So you know, the margin of maneuver of Susan Rice inside, of Samantha Power inside the UN is going to be extremely limited, because they know what the US can do in terms of trying to sell a fiction or a chimera to the UN Security Council. Susan Rice is more complicated. For instance, there's no evidence she has any clue what the pivot is all about.
Say that again.
Pivoting to Asia.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is a Tom Donilon creation. We all know that. He conceptualized the pivoting. He sold it to Obama, and Obama announced the pivoting at the Pentagon. Obviously, Tom Donilon conceptualized it, sitting down with Pentagon analysts, of course. It's very, very interesting. I was in Singapore last week, and guess who showed up in town? Chuck Hagel. We all know that. At least this was noticed in the US. He went for the Shangri-La dialogue, which is the number one Southeast Asian, defense lunch and dinner annually. And he was in Southeast Asia, here in my neighborhood, selling the pivoting to the Southeast Asians. The thing is, this year they had a prime guest, the Chinese. They were there. And they had it was not a low-level delegation. There was a PLA general. So this guy confronts Chuck Hagel during the Shangri-La dialogue and says, look, you're here trying to sell your pivoting. You're trying to comfort your allies in the region. And at the same time, you are trying to contain China. So which is which? Obviously, Hagel, he did not have any answer. Said, no, we're going to try the usual plan. We're going to try to work together. But this was 1 week before the California Dreaming Summit between President Xi and President Obama. So I wonder where Susan Rice fits into all this. She doesn't know anything about Asia. She doesn't know anything about how the pivoting was conceptualized. She has an antagonistic vein, which I tend to think she's going to antagonize the Chinese even more than Tom Donilon was. Tom Donilon was a very discreet character. I see it as Obama as an American sultan with his courtiers around and inside the Topkapi White House. This is the simple. Might be far off the mark here.
Very, very interesting. All right, now let's turn to Turkey, where for the past week, and we're speaking here on June 7th, there have been protests on a daily basis that expanded from Istanbul, where a plan to tear down trees in a valued park produced a local protest. And we have on-the-ground reports that in 65 of the 81 cities in Turkey, there have been significant demonstrations almost daily for the past week. And the Erdogan government has tipped its hand that it's got a real nasty attitude toward both the protesters and to social media, which Erdogan says is just a pack of lies. And while there was, one day when the soldiers and cops tried a softer approach, for the most part, the crackdown has been brutal, with water cannons, dispersing of pepper spray and tear gas, and we have reports of a number of deaths from these protests so far. Sibel, let's turn to you for a narrative here, because as a native, you have many sources there and family members too. So tell us your thoughts about this widespread protest movement in Turkey.
Well, still is developing the situation in Turkey, and it's expanding. The cause actually started with what we call catalyst, because there were a lot of high level of tension simmering, brewing in Turkey for a while. And several factors were causes of this simmering in Turkey. And the catalyst was this Gezi Park in Taksim that started the explosion, and that's the best way to characterize it after all this under-the-radar simmering that's been taking place in Turkey. People have been very unhappy with Erdogan's government. And in the last few months, it really got much worse, and it escalated. I would say one of the top reasons actually has been Erdogan's stand, his attitude on Syria. Basically, Erdogan, from the beginning, long before it was reported here in the U.S. media, a year before even Syria became issue, we at Boiling Frogs Post, we broke the story on how in Turkey the rebels were being trained together with NATO and Turkey on the border. And of course, no one picked it up here in the United States. So Erdogan has been instrumental in creating these rebel situations in Syria, training of these terrorists, including the Al-Qaeda elements. And that for the people in Turkey, that's a huge deal. Because up until that point, Turkey and Syria, they have been having this really nice, smooth relationship. Yes, we have had some tensions throughout the recent history with Syria. But if you go and comb through all the press releases, all the photo up between with Assad and with Erdogan, you know, they are our brother nation. And you have to also remember, you know, during the Ottoman Empire, basically we were one, Turkey and Syria. In fact, my grandmother's mother, she lived there. I mean, and that was part of, you know, the Turkish territory. So you are looking at people who identify themselves with people there. You know, you're sharing the same religion. So for Erdogan to be known as an Islamic AKP government, yet being so instrumental in creating, in manufacturing the situation with Syria, that was a big deal for the Turkish people. The media there in Turkey was a bit better than U.S. media, but because of the influence of both government and also Gulen movements, which I'm not going to really get into it, they haven't really reflected this discontent, this outrage by the Turkish people when it comes to Erdogan and his stand and him being instrumental to these despicable U.S. Foreign practices. Now, on top of that, Erdogan was left by the United States out there after Erdogan committed himself and his government and did all these things. And what we started witnessing in the past few months, with the situation getting to this point where U.S. has been kind of getting a cold feet on Syria, you know, with arming the rebels and even on these chemical weapons situation. I wouldn't be surprised if the story was concocted initially between the United States and Turkey on this. Let's have this chemical weapons situations. Hey, it worked with Iraq, you know, WMD. Why not use it with Syria? But then U.S. turned around and said, well, this is not conclusive. And we don't know who really used it. When Erdogan came forward and says, we've got reports that the Syrian government has been using these chemical weapons. Then, of course, we had that major bombing incident in Reyhanlı at the border of, you know, the border of Syria and Turkey. Again, that was a huge deal because it appeared to be a false flag operations. Right away, Erdogan came out and said they had evidence that this was concocted and carried out by Assad's regime and et cetera. And of course, later the reports came out that no, that was not the case. It was the opposite. So the situation with Syria has been playing a very important role in the attitudes of people, majority in Turkey, against Erdogan, even supporters of Erdogan. A lot of these people, they actually voted for AKP administration. So you have had that. Of course, the economic situation in Turkey, even though compared to Europe, it's been, it's been looking pretty bright. But you have had this largening gap between the rich and poor. So there have been some, economic factors that have played role in the discontent that we have been seeing with, people against Erdogan's government. Add to that the latest with, of course, it's been ongoing with Turkey since the military regime and coup in 1980s, the clampdown on media. If you look at the recent reports, you would see that Turkey has the worst record when it comes to jailing of journalists. And here is a country that President Obama declared as the role model for democracy in Middle East. So that's what I guess Obama loves to see. He loves to see a regime that clamps down on journalists and jails them and torture them. And if you look at the track record of the Turkish government, including the escalation during the Erdogan administration, you will see what I'm talking about here. Now, add to that some of the other environmentalists, which was, it was actually a small issue with Taksim. And again, add to that some of the latest stuff happening with the Kurdish situation. I kind of liken the situation to Iran in 1977, 1978, when I was there. My father was he was part of this whole revolution, okay? And what you saw was, a lot of people with even big time differences put their differences aside and they were united against the Shah regime for various reasons. And that is similar to what you see in Turkey. I mean, you see people, with a strong stand on these Kurdish issues. You see people with a strong stance on the human rights issues. Then you have Muslims there who actually voted for AKP's Erdogan government, and they are pissed. They are outraged that Erdogan would betray a neighbor nation, a Muslim nation, a nation that Turks identify with. So you bring all these elements, and then you bring this, Gezi Park incident. That's when you got the catalyst and everything started blowing up.
Now, Sibel, one question I do have about the role of the Gulen movement in the current protests in Turkey relates to a WikiLeaks cable that was sent in 2009. It was released by WikiLeaks. I don't want to make it sound like they sent it. By the U.S. ambassador, James Jeffrey, to his minders in Washington. And he stated that the Gulen followers dominate the Turkish police. Do you believe that's true? And if so, are they simply following Erdogan's orders in cracking down, or are they working to kind of triangulate and isolate Erdogan by being, more heavy-handed with the protesters?
Well, that's a pretty loaded question. The first question, have they penetrated the Turkish police? And I would include Turkish military in there. See, because Gulen movements, they've been working on this for a long, long time. Because this started in mid-1990s. This was 1996, 1997. And if you go and listen to Fethullah Gulen's speech before he was kicked out of Turkey, actually, he was going to be jailed. But the CIA put Mr. Gulen, Imam Gulen, in this Gulf Stream. They brought him to United States. And Fethullah Gulen has been living here in the United States with his $22 billion network. It's an NGO network of Islamization. They have opened over 300 mosques and madrasas in Central Asia and Caucasus. They have been doing it actually in the Balkans. And they have been placing and expanding their influence in Turkey very methodically, but consistently, okay? And so that, if you listen to his preaching, his speeches recorded, and they're available on YouTube. Of course, they are in Turkish. You would hear what he says. He actually spells it out. He says, what we want is we want to get these people from the madrasa age 8, 7, 8, 9, and we want to educate them. We want to sponsor them going to universities, and we want to help them to place and, to be positioned within the arteries of the Turkish government and within the arteries of the media. And this speech was delivered in mid-1990s, and they have been very successful. If you look at the newspaper Zaman, well, Zaman is owned and operated by Fethullah Gulen's network. Okay, then you're looking at İhlas Holding that owns most of, the media outlets in Turkey. You're looking at one of the main Gulen movement's operators. Same thing with the Turkish government, both police but also military, interestingly. If you look at the new generation military officers, the younger ones, you will see a lot of, Gulen network people, people who grew up within Gulen network. Now, has there been an influence there? And that's a very interesting question because they actually, Gulen movement and Erdogan's government, they were close, okay? And especially with Gul, and that's another different dynamics, and that is the difference between Erdogan and Gul because you have some conflicts there. They are not on board and everything, and they have been splitting in many ways with their approaches, and Gul being the president, Erdogan being the prime minister, but you have seen this fallout between the Gulen and also Erdogan administration, which is about a few years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't be surprised. I don't want to state any facts because I don't have them, but I have been reading articles and analysis in Turkey saying that, you know, part of this movement is also Gulen network feeding it as well with their own set of agenda, because they have been very unhappy with Erdogan for several reasons, not only in one area, but in several areas. And as you know, Fethullah Gulen is very much so supported by Israel. That's another interesting angle here. And as I said, he has been working with the CIA since 1997. So you get all these elements together, and to answer your question, have they penetrated the military and the police force? Absolutely. There are actually some statistics that they talk about the percentage of the penetrated officers within the Turkish police force and also Turkish military by Fethullah Gulen's movement. And how much of what's happening right now with the protests in Turkey is supported and actually fortified by Gulen? There are some speculations. I think we are going to hear more about it. Outwardly, the Gulen movement, including Fethullah Gulen, they haven't issued any statements. So they have been quiet. But we don't know what they have been doing in the background. And I think in the next few days, we're going to find out more about that.
All right. And Pepe, what is your perspective on the protests in Turkey?
That would be my question to Sybil, how much the military are infiltrated by Gulen? I cannot find this answer.
There has been some articles and analysis, and some people are attaching statistics. For example, with the police force, gendarma in Turkey, they're saying it's close to 70%, and I believe that. With the military, again, I don't know how scientific they are. They are putting the percentage around 30-35%, but when they talk about this percentage, they're talking about higher level officers. Again, Turkish military is divided now into two, and that is the older generations, and you're looking at these 4-5 stars generals, and you know, even people a few steps below them who've been within the system since 1980s coup, and that is the coup d'etat by U.S., and then military regime was installed in Turkey. So these people were known and are known to be secularists. They are the ones who actually hate Erdogan, and we, of course, know about Ergenekon, which is another interesting twist in this. So in these movements, you have Islamist people who have been unhappy with Erdogan because of Syria. And then you have Gulen movement, who has been, separating itself from Erdogan. They have had some major disagreements. You have the real socialist movement in Turkey. You have the environmentalists. So you're looking at all these different factions. But with military, with Ergenekon, I wouldn't be surprised if they also, and these are the militarists, secularists, the older generation, the nationalists, ultra-nationalists, including some of the fascists within the military faction that like to fuel the protests because of all the clampdown. If you look at the last couple of years, you're seeing all these major name generals that Erdogan has been jailing. And of course, Erdogan has had U.S. blessing. So the generals who were installed there in Turkey by the United States government, by the United States of America, now they find themselves on the other side of the fence when they are being jailed, and the support is for the so-called role model democracy, the new modern Islamist regime in Turkey. So I would say the military would be divided. If you look at one of the videos that became very popular in Turkey, you actually see some military people handing out people some, you know, masks in order to resist, you know, the tear gas and the gassing that the police has been using there, which is very interesting. So you're looking at the segment that is not pro-Erdogan, and the military segment that is not pro-Erdogan is further divided to two groups. One group is the old line military. Those were the U.S.-installed ultra-nationalists. The other segments would be the Fethullah Gulen movements, planted military people who started from the bottom level, and they have been working their ways up. And you will see Fethullah Gulen's network's percentage increase among officers as years go by, because they went from that bottom level with the intention of penetrating Turkish military.
But no, this explains the brutality of the repression. Let's assume that the police is 70% infiltrated or controlled by Gulenists. What would be their agenda to orchestrate? Obviously, they have no idea in terms of crowd control or, you know, in Europe, this could... okay, apart from the French, Cineas, they tend to be very brutal. No? But I would say in some European countries, they would know how to control 1,000 people in a park, for instance. And the way they did it in Istanbul, it sounded to me like it was on purpose. Let's intimidate these people, and we're going in 2 or 3 hours, we get rid of the whole stuff. Do you see any malignant orchestration behind that, the way the police brutality was articulated?
I think that's an excellent question. And I think that question will be answered in the next few days, because right now all we are seeing is chaos, and it's so hard to separate now various factions within the protest groups. Again, some of these military people who came, and some people, they're saying they were police who were handing out these masks to people, versus the brutality exercised by the police. And also, I'm very interested to see what kind of response and reaction we're going to get from the United States, because right now Erdogan seems to be a pretty much alone. A lonely man out there with many, many enemies, with people that, you know, he put on the other side of the fence. And right now it is so difficult to separate these factions. But that's a very, very good question. And in fact, one of my contacts in Turkey, not a reporter, in fact, this person is an AKP supporter. She has voted, you know, twice for AKP, and she told me she believes that all the stuff are orchestrated, and some of them are influenced with those people with vendetta against Erdogan, and they want to create this, you know, this chaos and fuel it in order to see, you know, Turkey get to be, you know, totally drowned in this chaos. And the whole economic situation that was supposedly, according to this person, was looking better and better, for Turkey. And now it's, coming to deterioration. If you look at the stock market in Turkey and what's happening there, it has a terrible impact on Turkish economy. And the other thing this lady brought up had to do with the Erdogan's position on EU and the fact that there is this now very strong resentment against EU, and people in Turkey don't want to become part of the EU. I mean, it's amazing, because just in the past 1.5 year, Turkey has been getting thousands of applicants from all over Europe who are looking for job in Turkey, which is kind of, in a way, it's ironic and it's funny. And you have been seeing a lot of investment from the Arab nations in Turkish, you know, stock market and various developmental projects in Turkey. And if you look at most of the investment, the foreign investment foreign capital that has been coming to Turkey, you're going to be seeing Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and, you know, Kuwait, and that's what you're seeing. And with some Turkish people who have been unhappy with Erdogan, saying Erdogan's stand that still wants to be part of EU is against what most people want in Turkey. And we should just completely put that aside and say we don't want to have anything to do with the EU in terms of becoming part of the EU.
Yeah, I was going to talk about this influx of Gulf money, especially because because the bubble, the real, especially the enormous real estate bubble, especially around Istanbul with those mega projects, right? It's basically Gulf money. And it's interesting. What I found extremely interesting, if I read it correctly, correct me if I'm wrong, of course, because Gezi Park was just the tip of the iceberg of these new mega projects, right?
Yes. Because yes.
The Ottoman barracks and build a shopping mall, whatever.
Yes.
Mega projects is a third port, a third bridge over the Bosphorus.
Yes.
It's a state speculation all over the northern part of Istanbul.
Yes.
Right. And this is all basically financed by Gulf money into a real speculation bubble and their privileged connections with AKP, right?
Absolutely. And they are now starting this project of the biggest airport in entire Europe, which is going to be the third airport in international airport in Istanbul. That's going to be the fanciest and the biggest airport in entire Europe.
Exactly. And my question to you, Sybil, who would like to crash this party between Gulf money, real estate speculators linked to the AKP, and obviously Erdogan connections inside the AKP? Facts or the Gulenists?
I would love to hear your take on this, because it is baffling. If I'm looking at the opposing factions, okay, forget the people. It's never about the people, right? So forget the people, but you look at the faction leaders, whether it's Fethullah Gulen, or when you're looking at the militarists, the ultra-nationalists, and then, of course, look also outside Turkey and say, you look at the foreign aspects of it. Who would be most intimidated and who wants to crash this? What is your take on this?
No, I don't really. For the moment, I don't have it. I think we're still, as you said, it's still a jigsaw puzzle. We are trying to see where it leads. There's one element in terms of relationship between Turkey and Europe. These past few months, there was a look east component to Turkish.
Yes.
It's more or less like let's abandon Europe. After all, who wants to relationship with a declining superpower and a full of unemployed people for life? So let's make better deals with our Gulf friends. Let's make more deals with our Russian friends. Let's invest in Central Asia. So it's basically a look east policy, right?
Yes.
So I would say the Europeanists in Istanbul are not very happy with that. But who are they?
No, that's a very good question. Because, you see, this is one of the games that usually played by countries that are positioned in this strategic artery, such as Turkey, such as Pakistan. And it's a game that is usually carried out. For example, with Pakistan, you know, they ask IMF and US, you know, give us more money and we want this. If not, if things go a little bit sour, they turn around and say, fine, we are going to go out and make a deal with China, okay? Or we're going to make a deal with Iran with this, you know, or this Gwadar port. And the same thing happens with Turkey, with Erdogan. Behind the scenes, they always are in this position of, you know, demanding these are the things we want. And if you don't do it, then we're going to do this. And that was one of the things that came up during one of the disagreements. That was when Erdogan says, fine, we are looking east. We're going to be part of SEO. And that made the headlines that part of the world. And again, it was not played at all here in the U.S. media. So even with that, you're looking at people in Europe. You're looking at the shadow, the real government, the powers behind Europe not being happy with that direction that Turkey has been taking. And it just went beyond talks because it was first, if you know, you don't do that, then we're going to look towards China or Russia. But then actually they started taking steps towards this. And then you're also looking at the relationship that still is pretty lukewarm with Iran. When we have that simmering in the background too, because still the commerce between Turkey and Iran is pretty substantial. It's not insignificant. So yes, I wonder too, and I keep reading all the different analyses that are being put hourly by various, you know, analysts in Turkey, the reporters, but I haven't seen anyone really asking this particular question. That's why I said that's an excellent question.
Me neither, Sybil. Me too. I'm reading from all different sources, and it's true. Nobody, I think we need a follow-up in 2 or 3 weeks, like I said.
Well, Pepe, let's move toward closure here and get a quick update from you on your efforts to secure a visa to cover the upcoming Iranian election.
I gave up. I know these people. I've done this before. Other friends that I have in European media, nobody got a visa. What I was told is that they had like 200 applications from journalists all over the world for visas. What I got from another source in Tehran is that, look, they're going to give just a handful. A handful, in my view, will be like 10 or 12. So not counting the correspondents who are already there. So they're probably going to give 10 visas from a bunch of journalists from all over. So I think they are still selecting who they want. It's weird because, you know, I've been there many times before. They have my dossier, my NSA style, everything. So there will be no reason not to give me a visa. But I gave up for another reason as well. When you look at the 8 candidates, oh my God, and I saw some excerpts of the debate that they had this week, it's really hardcore. There's no competition, in fact. And it looks to me like it's an already done deal. The supreme leader, he wants Saeed Jalili, the nuclear negotiator, mm-hmm. very close to the supreme leader. They don't want not a shred resemblance with what happened in 2009. It has to be totally controlled. So this means they don't want foreign journalists over there, you know. So I'm relying on the people that I know in Iran, some inside the government and some are outsiders. And it's very complicated. And if you're going to be there during the election, I would figure that I will have a much better perspective from the outside, because then I can compare from left and right and try to at least look at the big picture. If you are in Iran under this condition, and on top, he told me that the internet is been crawling to a halt practically. Mm-hmm. You won't be able to travel. You won't be able to talk to opposition figures because they are in jail or in under house arrest. So what's the point, you know? So unfortunately for this one, I took a pass.
All right. And do you, it sounds like you think it's a pretty well-wired deal by eliminating Rafsanjani and the guy that Ahmadinejad was trying to insert. The Election Commission basically shaped the pool of candidates in a way that appears to predestine the outcome.
Well, it's only loyalists, and some are slightly less loyalists than others, but everybody is extremely inside the system. Some people in Tehran say that the mayor of Tehran, Kalibaf, would be not a new Ahmadinejad figure, but he would deviate from the script. No, no way. The way things are being run now, which is this is what I've been calling since 2009. And obviously, I created a lot of enemies inside Iran because of that. It is a military dictatorship of the Mullahtariat, the way I describe it. Mm. It's team leader, the hardcore clerics in Qom, and the Revolutionary Guards. That's it. They control everything. And after what happened in 2009, they are not taking any chances at all. You know. So what happened with Rafsanjani at the last minute? He said he had a chance because Khatami said, no, I'm not going to run because they're going to cut me off. So Rafsanjani, he registered, I think, in the last 10 minutes. Of the last day for registration. And he thought that he had a shot because he could then congregate all the various strands of the opposition. But, you know, the fact is the Guardian Council, they only do what the Supreme Leader wants them to do. Period. That's it. So they disqualified everybody from the start. And when they had 600 people who actually applied, they disqualified everybody. And they, okay, we have these eight. They are part of the system. It cannot go wrong. And there is not a loose cannon like Ahmadinejad in his first election, 2005. So, unfortunately, I see it as, as you said, a pretty up deal.
All right. Well, Pepe, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks for joining this lively conversation today, and we will have to circle back and connect up with you again sooner than later.
Connect all the dots in Turkey. It's going to take a while.
Pepe Escobar here on The Boiling Frogs.
On us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.